So thank you, guys. What I would like to do today, first I'll give you just a quick overview. The center that I work for is brand new. We're the Center for Research in Education and Social Policy. I have to say I was pretty excited as the RWJF rolled out their framework in education and so prominently positioned there. Our work is really about improving student achievement and reducing gaps in childcare in K-16. We also work to improve access and consumption to healthy foods and to advance understandings of the connections between education and social policy and health. This research in part was paid for by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and I don't have any other relationships to disclose. So what I wanted to do today is give you a brief overview of what we have, at least in the public health literature, and some of the, a little bit of the marketing literature, but not as much, about in-store marketing studies to date. This is an area that I've been doing more and more work in, and I think we're starting to get more momentum in research in the public health space on this, but it's still kind of sparse. Then I'd like to share with you the findings from this one public-private partnership, which was very robust and had a lot of moving parts. It was a dynamic partnership for a pretty large in-store marketing campaign where we targeted 73,000 customers, it's not a typo, across 48 stores in the state of Arizona, and then talk a little bit about the implications. So let's just talk briefly about how I ended up, as a public health professional studying marketing campaigns. So if we go back a little bit to where kind of the food access work began, at least from my vantage point, it really started with the early work identifying areas of the country that did and didn't have sufficient access to supermarkets. So probably many of you in this room, and we have two food trusters in the room, are familiar with the Pennsylvania Fresh Food Financing Initiative, which really kind of kickstarted this idea that you could bring together public and private money and together incentivize stores to relocate in underserved neighborhoods. So that effort really began this, what still continues today, financing trajectory of getting more stores to locate in underserved neighborhoods. But what then comes about in the conversation is, well, you know, obviously supermarkets sell a lot of different kinds of foods, and how then do we direct consumers to the healthier foods in the store? And that then starts to take you down this, what kinds of things are happening in store, how do we measure what's going on in the store, what are the in-store marketing campaigns that are going on, and how can we manipulate them, right? So there's a nice overview that was done by Karen Glantz and colleagues in 2012 of in-store marketing, and she organizes it in terms of the four P's: price, promotion, placement, and product, which those of you who know this work know that's relatively common for us. And so that's kind of a good first, you know, overview of the field if you're looking. And then since then, Gary Foster and Karen Glantz and I have completed a randomized controlled trial which looks at placement and promotion strategies in stores. And I did bring a copy of that study if anybody wants it. It's a couple years old now, but it's one of the few U.S. in-store marketing randomized controlled trials that's been published. And I'll go through a couple of the findings from that study. And then we have a representative here, too, who will be talking about the HIP pilot. But I think the HIP pilot is another really seminal work in in-store marketing in the country, which talks a little bit about how well these financial incentives do to move the needle on purchasing. When it comes to in-store couponing specifically, there is pretty limited research. In the Glantz review, there was a nice summary of some of the research, and I'm going to go through one more study that I also pulled in, knowing now that the HIP pilot isn't something I need to cover that in depth. Which was a randomized controlled trial out of New Zealand where they were able to coupon, actually it wasn't couponing, it was a discount on purchases of 12.5%, and they found some movement on a specific basket of products, so products that they identified in advance. So just a little bit of a look at the literature here. The 2012 review looks at 5 years of publications from, actually that's not five, it's 15, from 1995 to 2010. And looked only at the physical grocery stores and food products, and then they, of course, characterized this by price, promotion, placement, and product. And so the findings aren't necessarily rocket science, but it's nice grounding for this work, where if you increase availability or affordability, and also the prominence and promotion while demarketing unhealthy foods, you can probably impact purchasing. But we still know that we need a number of in-store tests, which I hope this is one that will be contributing to the literature shortly. One of the big challenges is that, you know, in-store marketing and couponing, many of us have been clipping coupons for a long time. Most coupons that get redeemed actually come from those circulars that are in your newspaper. I'm sure we're all familiar with them. Redemption rates are pretty low, but a lot of people do clip coupons. Is not new, but the data on that redemption and how much it moves the needle has been traditionally pretty proprietary. So one thing that was exciting for me about this study is it was the first time that we really partnered with industry to take a look at how they run their numbers and get a sense of what the kinds of impacts are for couponing campaigns. The HIP pilot, I'll definitely let the HIP pilot expert talk about her own pilot, but you know, basically it was, again, a price promotion strategy. The other one I just added here, it came from New Zealand, and they, I can give you the reference here, but they basically looked at 8 supermarkets. It was a randomized controlled trial. They had 1,104 shoppers who they identified from these stores, and they randomly assigned them to get one of these four conditions. What they found was that the price discount condition was the one that had the biggest effect on the basket of products, and they had a pretty interesting approach where as shoppers shop, they actually scanned the products as part of the general shopping approach in these stores. So they were able to track through customer frequent buyer cards exactly what was in that basket and over time. And so customers just got mailed home a price discount letter saying that they had been, you know, randomly assigned to get this discount if they wanted it, and then they looked at it shifts in the basket. The shifts weren't enormous, but they did find that they bought 11% more of the healthy basket products, which they pre-identified, and those were the same ones then that they got the 12.5% discount. You might say, why 12.5%? That's what I wondered. Turns out that that's the same amount as the value-added tax that they have in New Zealand, so it basically eliminated the tax. And that they bought so they bought 11% more at 6 months and 5% more at 12 months. So other than that, there's really not much data on interventions at the store level for couponing programs in the public health literature. So this was the other study that I mentioned I brought with me, where we looked at a large pilot study in 8 supermarkets in the Philadelphia area. And what we did was we applied a number of different kinds of approaches, multiple facings, which is basically means if I have a box of Cheerios and normally there's just one box of Cheerios on the shelf, now I've put two side by side, so there's two facings of Cheerios. So that example is a real one. That is one of the products that we multiple faced. We also looked at prime placement. So many have probably heard that you want products at eye level. You want to get them sort of in the center of the shelf. And this differs by category. So we tried to maximize placement depending on where it was. If it was a checkout cooler, so you know where you pick up a drink as you're on your way out of a checkout aisle, we would move water up to prime placement there. Some basic signage. Now we were really focused on not having a health message or any messaging at all. So our signage in this study was really just the price bigger on a more colorful tag, which seemed to effectively draw attention. We did some taste testing around the milk, and we had some secondary placement, which basically means, you know, putting the cereal next to the milk, or the milk. Well, you can't really that easily put milk next to cereal, but you get what I'm saying. And then doing some cross promotion in that regard. And what we found in this study is that we did find positive results in three different food categories: milk, frozen entrees, and beverage checkout coolers. And we're right now in the midst of a new R01 study, which is scaling this up from 8 supermarkets to 32 supermarkets and looking at a number of additional categories in the store. So hopefully I'll be back next year talking about some results from that. And this is just some basic trend data on how and where we had impact. So in aisle beverage sales, we moved kind of the needle on Aquafina, but we did not change anything in Pepsi and Diet Pepsi. We only targeted those two sodas, and unfortunately that aisle is full of a lot of sodas. And then another place that I'll just draw your attention is on checkout beverage sales, where we, again, were able to move the needle on water. Water definitely is the most viable alternative to soda, in my view. It's easy to sell, relatively speaking. And then milk sales, you can see that we had an impact on milk. So that leads me to our current study, which was a couponing effort in Arizona. This was a huge partnership, as I mentioned. Donna Levine is also in the audience, and she was instrumental in helping us negotiate a lot of these deals with the Heart Association and with Bosch's to actually execute this coupon in the stores. So Bosch's Food City Supermarkets, Bosch's is a major chain in Arizona, and Food City is their store brand that's really tailored toward the Hispanic Latino audience. They have other brands that are targeted toward different kinds of consumers. The American Heart Association was on board. They really wanted to test a part of their Heart Check program, and they contributed also financially to some of the analysis that Catalina Systems did. And Arizona State University, Poonam there, had worked on some of the research here as well. Catalina Systems, for those who don't know, is I call it like the extra receipt you get at checkout. So you get your actual receipt, but then you get another ticket that prints out, and it typically will print a coupon or a message, get your haircut for $1 less or something. So that's the system that we used to track sales, and it's pretty advanced, and it really helped us make headway on this research design. So really our goal was to identify an intervention where we could focus in on one category for couponing. And it became clear very early on that we needed one category because there was so many people at the table with so many different interests that it was going to be really hard for us to agree on more than one category. So we decided that one would be good. And then we wanted to incorporate the American Heart Check program because American Heart was at the table, and we wanted to represent a reasonable shift from a higher to a lower calorie product for the consumer. It needed to be cost neutral or better for the supermarket. It had to be feasible to implement, and we wanted to use retail strategies, including price promotion, merchandising, and marketing. And so we ended up landing on milk as a great go-to category, not because I'm a huge fan of all things that are dairy products, but just because it's a relatively simple category. There's not that many different competitors in that market. The store has a lot of control over it. And as it turns out, in Arizona, you can coupon it. That's not the case in every state in America. You cannot coupon it in Pennsylvania, for example. But in Arizona, you could. So it was a good test for us there. We also looked at doing things in-store. So we actually launched a marketing campaign across all the Food City stores for the lower-fat milk. And what we ended up doing was radio ads in Spanish and English. We also had refrigerator clings and hang tags on lower-fat milk. And because it was such a strong partnership with Bosch's, we didn't have to have an enormous staff to make sure these things got hung up. The store managers and in-store folks were able to do that. I think more and more now, as we have supermarket dietitians on staff, they're willing to take on some of these tasks as well. And then we had messaging available before we launched the coupon so that there was like a priming of participants that this was coming. And I say that now because when you look at the results, you have to take that into consideration. In total, we ended up with a $2 coupon, which is pretty sizable coupon. That represented about a 60 to 75% off, depending on the week. The price fluctuated a bit, but it was a pretty significant shift. It was a one-time only coupon, though, so people weren't able to access the coupon multiple times, though we did track multiple purchases. And I mentioned tracking was done through Catalina Systems, and what they were able to do is actually go back in time for us and pull people who had exclusively purchased full-fat milk. And then we could coupon those exclusive full-fat milk buyers for the lower-fat milk to see if they would switch. So it was a pretty instrumental component of our research design. So just an example of one of the in-store radio marketing scripts. I didn't write this script. This came from the supermarket dietitian, who was a strong partner, and she really wanted to do something on radio. Not all stores had radio, but it's a great outlet if you can get access to it. So basically, we looked at six-month purchase data to identify the full-fat milk purchasers. So they had to exclusively purchase full-fat milk for 6 months prior to the start of the study. As I mentioned, there were 48 stores, 73,000 shoppers in the end met the criteria where they had shopped and purchased full-fat milk exclusively. And then from that, we randomly selected 20,000 to receive a coupon. And we did a six-week rolling expiration. One of the concerns was that we were not rich and we could not afford, if redemption rates became really high, to pay out all of it. So we went for that rolling coupon so that we could track how we were doing as we were going along and we wouldn't end up hopefully broken. I should say I did this research while I was at the food trust too, so there was really concerned about being broke. And then we issued the coupons over 16 weeks. This is an example here of what the actual coupon looked like. In total, we issued 44,000 coupons, and we had a redemption rate of about 5.3%. In total, that meant that 824 more families did end up trying low-fat milk who had the coupon. We saw that purchases increased by about 5.8% for those who received the coupon. And then this is where the trick, 4% of those who did not receive the coupon, but who were also exclusive full-fat milk buyers before the intervention, also end up purchasing low-fat milk. We're not exactly sure why. We do know that we did the in-store marketing campaign for all stores, so it's possible that that's why. It could also be that for whatever reason people just decided to switch. So that's a consideration. And then we looked at the repurchase rate. So if they tried low-fat or skim milk and they received a coupon, 42% decided to purchase it a second time. And I'll show you another chart that breaks down exactly what that looked like. In general, the average repeat volume was about 3.24 gallons, and it happened over 2.76 trips. So if you round up, it's about, you know, a gallon a trip for three successive trips. And then of those 42% who did repurchase, again, 57% of them made two or more purchases. So once they decide to repurchase, it seems like the bulk of people do continue to repurchase. So here's just a chart over time of how the data looked. And again, you see that 4% of people who had never purchased before did end up purchasing. And again, we don't exactly know if that was because of the in-store marketing campaign, though I suspect that it did have something to do with that. And then here's a simple breakdown of the repeat. So, you know, those are 42% who decided to repeat purchase, and then of those, the breakdown of one repeat, two repeat, three repeat, four repeat. So in conclusion, we know that they're relatively expensive, but it does seem like this in-store marketing approach to decreasing price through couponing does hold promise for healthier food purchases. I think, too, using and relying on the partnerships and the infrastructure that stores already have has promised. That said, you know, one of the detriments was that we couldn't really do some of the more sophisticated analysis that we wanted to because we were really reliant on our partners and their data collection tools. We know, too, that if folks were to switch to reduced fat milk, the calorie savings is about 1,000 calories. If they switch from whole to skim, 700 calories from whole to 1%, which represents a pretty sizable caloric savings over the course of a week, even if it was split across a family. And if you multiply that out times a year, it really becomes enormous numbers. And it's really hard to figure out what exactly the industry standard is, especially now that we have electronic coupons, but it seems like my 5.3% is a little bit higher than industry standard, which is around 2.3%. And I think I'd like to think it was because of our excellent intervention, but I think, too, milk is really such a staple that when people get a coupon for it, they're more likely to use it than, you know, a strange detergent that we don't often use. So I think we don't know exactly how this would translate into other categories, though I would imagine there's probably some similarities for other staples, you know, bread, cheese, milk. And we also were not able to follow cash customers. So one of the limitations of this is that we were following people who were using a card. And if they didn't have a card, then we couldn't track their purchases, and so they wouldn't have been eligible for the coupon in the first place, and we wouldn't have been able to follow up with them. That said, too, if a buyer, you know, transitioned to a cash purchase somewhere in the middle, you know, we wouldn't have been able to track them on an ongoing basis. This particular store did not have a loyalty card, so that wasn't an option for us. And we know, too, that all shoppers were exposed to the in-store marketing. And while that is a limitation, I think, too, people don't always shop at one store. So I'm not sure how you would be able to control for some of that exposure in other settings. So that is an overview. And I think, are we going to take questions at the end, or do you want to take questions?